Just a quick mention to our Melbourne listeners. I am heading over to the MCG on the 8th of March for the Toddle School Leaders Meetup. Yes, that's right. The Toddle School Leaders Meetup being held at the MCG. I will be going one-on-one with the great one in Jan Owen as we explore the future of education in Australia. Hopefully you can join us there. The tickets are free. They share our vision for developing the best professional learning for free. So join us at the MCG on the 8th of March. Check out toddleapp.com/events/school-leaders-meetup-Melbourne or check out our show notes for the link. I look forward to seeing you there. This episode is brought to you by our friends at PeopleBench. PeopleBench specialise in helping schools build their collective workforce and retain staff. We all know the future of work is fast, flexible and connected, and we know the crunch for talented teachers is on our doorstep. PeopleBench are here to help you manage and plan your workforce with an intuitive platform that can provide all the data you need to make an evidence-informed decision about your next staff workforce strategy. Head to peoplebench.com to learn more. Welcome to Ed Leaders, the podcast covering all the interesting ideas about leadership, strategy, culture, and the business of K-12 education. I'm your host, Luke Kelly, and joining me each week in the chair is my co-host and colleague, Matthew Irving. Before we get started, if you haven't already, you should sign up to the weekly email sent out by the team at Ed Leaders. What should someone expect in the email, Matt?
You ask me this question every week and I never have a great answer, but I think you can expect to see something different. You can expect to be able to read this newsletter in 2 minutes. Every edition is completely different, so you won't be reading the same things. So make sure you sign up. How was that?
I love putting you on the spot because it gets worse each week. Well done, Matt. Yeah. You can sign up for the newsletter at edleaders.com.au. Now on to today's guest. It is John Buchanan. For those of you who think, I know that name. Well, John was coach of the Australian men's cricket team from 1999 to 2007. He oversaw the rise of one of the most successful periods, probably maybe the most successful periods of Australian cricket, winning successive World Cups, multiple Ashes, including a whitewash, and a tour in India. His coaching record was 69 wins and 21 losses. Have I got that right, John? 69 wins, 21 losses?
Thereabouts, yes, I think.
Thereabouts, which makes you, I believe, one of the highest coaching records in any sport ever at 76.9%. Now, that's a decent clip, considering up against the likes of Phil Jackson. So anyway, without further ado, let's get to it. John, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks, Luke. Thanks, Matt. Great to be here.
How'd I go with that intro? Did I capture everything?
Obviously there's plenty more, but it's a nice summary.
All right, great. Now, we love to start the show by getting you to tell us a little bit about your personal and professional journey, particularly for you, I guess, in leadership and your coaching roles.
Sure. It's kind of where you start, but I suppose I'm actually celebrating my 70th birthday today, so I've got to wind the clock. Wind the clock back a few years.
Happy birthday. You're the second person that shared their birthday with us. We feel very privileged.
Absolutely.
There you go. I think my leadership journey is still continuing. I don't think it ever stops, really, because if it has stopped, I think that means you've stopped learning, or you've stopped the desire for learning about how you go about your life, how you go about the roles in your life, how you go about the relationships in your life. So still learning at this stage, but if I wind the clock back, probably it all started with my parents, you know, and it's a bit, maybe I'll wind the clock back but also wind it forward at the same stage, and that may give it a little bit of context. I took on my first professional cricket coaching role for Queensland in 1994. And at that point in time, I'd been 16 years away from having played for Queensland, and a very unsuccessful career that was. And at the time, Geoff Thompson, who was a legend of Australian cricket, was coaching Queensland with Martin Kent, who was also another famous player for Queensland in Australia and in World Series cricket. And they'd been there for about 4 years and had done reasonably well, but still Queensland, after 69 years of trying, still hadn't won a Sheffield Shield. So they advertised the role And I decided to apply. And to apply, I spoke to a good friend of mine who I had coached when he was a much younger player, Ian Healy. He was captain of Queensland at that point in time and also very much an integral member of the Australian cricket team. And I just wanted to know from him that if, hypothetically, I was given the job, would I be given an opportunity to coach the team? Because, you know, there was he, there was McDermott, Rackerman, Porter was coming back into the side, and a whole series of players that are either played for Australia or long-serving Queensland players. So how could this bloke who, as I said, 16 years before had only played one poor season for Queensland, now be expected to become head coach of the Queensland team, the Bulls team, chasing this thing called the Holy Grail, which they never, ever won? So what it made me do, and this is the leadership journey, is that if I was going to go into the room to an interview panel and present myself as a viable alternative to what they already had, then I had to actually understand myself. I actually had to understand how I coached. So the process was going back to when I was a young boy on the Gold Coast, you know, 5 or 6 year old, 7 year old, and my parents' influence. And their values and their principles. It was then about what happened at school and my journey there as a young boy who wanted still at a very early age to wear a baggy green cap. And that was my goal in life. That was my dream in life. So I kept chasing that through school and at university and playing with a whole range of players that had played for Australia and for Queensland. Then having that 1 year for Queensland, unsuccessful, as I said, and then beginning new journeys because that dream evaporated. After that one season, the Packer series finished and all the international players or the Packer contracted players all came back to the various states. So that meant there was really no room for me in that squad, and so it was time to set about other dreams, dreaming about being a sports administrator. Then that dream turned into being a professor at a university. Then that dream turned into being a director general of a Queensland government department. And so through all those experiences, that's what I cast my mind into and through as I was preparing to do this interview at Queensland Cricket for the Bulls head coaching role. And to do that, I used to run a lot in those days, and I'd run out along the river and just turn things over in my mind about all that journey and about all the things that were important to me, important to what I believed in, as in values and beliefs and principles and so on. And then also it spoke to me about, well, how do I interact with people? What do I say? What do I do? Why don't I say something? You know, why do I back off? Or why do some people see me as a person that, you know, is quiet at certain times and not other times? So that's kind of what I brought to bear. So when I went into that interview, I was well prepared to tell them what I was going to bring to the role. And one of those things was around vision, because I guess when I sort of put all my little pieces together about my philosophy, vision was very much at the forefront of that. Whatever I'd done, wherever I'd been, whether it was with myself, whether it was other people, whether it was teams that I was leading, it was always about, well, where can we be, you know, inspirationally and aspirationally? Where can I and where can we take this particular group, or where can you be if you have goals of being better than what you are currently? So vision was really important. So my presentation to them then focused in and around the Holy Grail, but saying that if all they wanted was some coach to come in and win them the Holy Grail, then I wasn't the person that they were looking for. They might as well continue down the path that they had already been. But I said what I would be doing is I want Queensland to dominate domestic cricket for the next 10 years. And to do that, we will look at all the systems and processes within the team and sort of surrounding the team and make the appropriate changes to those so that it will put us in a far better position to win a Sheffield Shield. And then, of course, if we do win one, then I think we'll be in a far better position to continue winning. So that was kind of, if you like, a bit of the personal and professional journey. And then, of course, I was with Queensland for 5 years and then moved on to the Australian team for a further 8 years. So, and then I'd coached in India and I coached in England. So there was, you know, around 15 years of head coaching in professional sport. And what I had learnt, what I believed again in all that process was that there is a shelf life in coaching, or a shelf life at least in head coaching. And that was really tested in 2005 when we lost an Ashes series, and we might touch on that later. But in 2005 we lost the Ashes. I'd been there 6 years, and basically they both wanted to get rid of the coach, because again, one of the key things in Australian sport is that most sports people get away with a lot of things, but there's one thing you can't do, and that's lose to the Poms. And so my head was on the chopping block at that stage. So I had to revisit and then mapped out to Cricket Australia what the next 20 months would look like, at which time I would exit if they gave me the opportunity to do that. And so that's how it unfolded, and that was my shelf life, last 20 months. And in the process of doing that, then I was setting up my Buchanan Success coaching business, which really is all about everything that I've learned along the way, but particularly in sport, the lessons that I've been able to take from that around creating world performance or world-class teams, the people that constitute that, both playing staff, support staff, and all the factors that impact upon the way a team and the way individuals perform. So I believed, you know, sport really encapsulates that so well, and it's so easy to see. So I wanted to take those lessons and then take them into the corporate world, which I've been doing since 2007. So that brings us to the current time.
Well, there's a lot to unpack there, John, and it's fantastic to hear the story. And, you know, there's two things that really resonate with me right at the beginning is just being honest about what you're bringing to a role. You know, there's an integrity piece and not trying to be someone they want you to be, but actually just being you. And I think some leaders, particularly people going for headship in schools, don't work that one out. And so it leads to an unhappy marriage, if you like. You know, and I think that's what's sort of been sort of displayed in what you've just sort of spoken about. And I'm also then interested, then you talked about the shelf life, you know, and teams, you know, or administration falling out of love with the coach or the leader. Do those two ideas sort of resonate then with what you're saying?
Yeah, 100%, Matt, because in the process of that 15-year journey, I had a couple of very unsuccessful head coaching roles. One was in Middlesex in 98, where I was still coaching Queensland, but I was at a point where I needed new challenges because I'd been with Queensland 4 years at that stage. And as I said, I believed I was kind of reaching a point where I needed to move on, not only for myself but also for the group. They needed other people to come in and take the team beyond where I believed I could take them. I must say I had a conversation with a head coach at the time. We had a little sort of informal group of head coaches around Queensland or around Brisbane, and it was Wayne Bennett who was coaching the Broncos. And, you know, he said to me, "That's rubbish." You know, he said, "Aren't you the best coach, career coach in Queensland?" And I said, "Well, at the moment I am, but I don't think I will be in the future, and I think it's better for the players to get some new input." And he said, "Like, here at the Broncos, one of two things will happen." He said, "Either I leave or the players leave." And he said, "I'm not going." So what Wayne was good at doing, and still is good at doing, is having a very simple sort of game plan, surrounding himself with people who just ultimately are so loyal and buy into that game plan. And then he's able to move others on and then refresh through new players and new support staff, you know, on an as-needs basis. And so that's what keeps his sort of, I think, coaching approach and his obviously successful coaching record well and truly intact. So Middlesex, I went over there and they brought me over to do what I've done in Queensland, because they'd been a very successful county for a long period of time but hadn't had success the last 10 or 15 years, and they wanted change. They wanted somebody to come in and bring about change so that they could put themselves back in that top bracket of county teams. So I arrived there only probably about 4 weeks before the start of the season. We went to a camp over in Spain where we did a lot of the cultural things that I had done in Queensland. For example, in those days, it was 98, so that's only, 25 years ago, I suppose that's a quarter of a century, but it doesn't seem that far ago. They used to have divisions between their capped players and their uncapped players, and very visible divisions by way of insignias on their jackets and on their caps and blazers and so on, and obviously different pay levels and different access to benefits and privileges. So there's a real divide. And so that was one of the things that I wanted to approach and change around. And, of course, good buy-in by all the players. The only thing at that particular camp was that their three English players, which was a new captain, Mark Rambrakash, and two older, well-established players within their team, Angus Fraser and Phil Tufnell, they were away in the West Indies playing for England. So they came back and we held a bit of a recap of what we'd done in Spain, and that all went really well. Everybody seemed to buy into it, and everybody left, apart from the club coach and the captain. And the club coach came over to me and said, look, the captain wants a couple of words with you. I said, oh, okay. And then Mark just and we hadn't met. This is our first meeting. We'd spoken maybe once or twice on a phone, but that was about it. He came over to me. He said, you don't make any changes in this club. The players don't make any changes in this club. If there are any changes to be made, I make them. So that was the start and the end of our first conversation. At which time, obviously taken aback because we'd done a heck of a lot and it all looked pretty good, but now he was kind of putting a line through that. But I thought, well, no, the way to do this is I'll just continually chip away at him, and so he'll see the benefits for him, and therefore we'll see some results in the field. And we got some early results, but what was happening was he wasn't buying into it and I was still determined to push it through. And so consequently, we bounced off each other. The tensions were felt in the dressing room, and suddenly our performances went downhill to the point where about two-thirds of the way through the season, the board came together and said, look, we've got a choice to make. We either retain Mark as captain in his first year and you go, or we retain you and we have another issue to deal with Mark, whether he retains the captaincy or not. There's only one winner there, and that's obviously the captain, and so I left. But to your point about integrity, the easy way for me, or the easier way for me, was to compromise in terms of the values, the principles, all the things that were important that not only to me, but I thought important to the team, if change was to occur and if the board were serious about what they wanted to achieve, further down the track. So, I put my job on the line and lost the role. Now a real disappointment. In fact, it was probably one of the loneliest times in my life and coaching career because I was still in England and there was about 6 or 7 weeks of the season to go, and I was just living in a house by myself and a lot of travel in England. So every time I kind of ventured to the ground, you were the dead man walking, and then you'd go home or drive and be home by yourself. So it was a very lonely sort of existence. But it did teach me something, or two things. One is that I would never compromise my values and principles. And that means whether you're a principal, whether you're a sports coach, whether you're a business leader, I just think you've got to be prepared to lose your job. Now, that's easy to say. And certainly my wife at the time just could not understand what I was doing and saying, that I was prepared to lose my job. I wasn't prepared to compromise on myself and values and principles to protect the job. But I just didn't believe that if I did that, I would find it more difficult if I was retained as a coach to continue coaching. So integrity is just so important always. And The other point, Mark, sorry, Matt, I've been going on for a bit on that one. What was the second one that you were talking about?
Oh, that idea of shelf life, and I think you've answered that quite well, you know, in terms of your principles, and you've got to be prepared not to compromise, and you've got to be prepared to lose your job. And I don't think that's something that we talk about in schools actually at all. It's quite significant.
No, but, you know, like I'm sure everybody is faced with that at different times, and, of course, everybody's circumstances are different, and therefore each individual has to make their own call. But it is certainly my strong belief that once you it's just the thin edge of the wedge, you know, kind of say, oh, look, I'll let it go this time, but I'll be right the next time. Well, I just don't think it works that way. And I mentioned the 2005 Asher series, so it comes to your point about the shelf life. The 2005 Asher series, you know, we'd won, you know, most things up until that point, as I said, but we lost the POM, so suddenly your head's on the chopping block. So while I always kind of review my performance and how I coach, this really brought it to a head that they said, right, you need to come down to the board and you've got, you know, we're going to meet in 2 weeks and you've got to justify to the board why you should be still retained as coach. So it took me back into all those principles and values and beliefs and my philosophy. And I think three quick key questions that, again, a lot of maybe emerging leaders in schools or indeed principals or deputy principals or those who, you know, are more heading up the operations side of the schooling have probably addressed at some point in time, and if they haven't, they will. And the first one was, it goes back to my, as I said, my vision, and that was, with this team, could I still make a difference? You know, and not just maybe a change of personnel here and maybe a change of training routine there and, you know, some other sort of minor changes. No, it was still about we were chasing our Everest, you know, so, and I wanted to continue that. And so could I still do that with the team? So that was the first question. Second question then was, so if I believed I could do that, did I still really want to? You know, did I still have the desire, the passion, the motivation to get up every day and look forward to trying to make an impact on the individuals or the team, whether we were together or not, the ability to try to get up and think about today but also think about the future. And so, you know, you're away a lot. We were 250 to 270 days a year, really. You're dealing with older children a lot of the times. There's the microscope of all the stakeholders, you know, media, as I said, the board, sponsors, public, family, all looking at what you're doing. So did I still have the desire to do that? And then the third question was to the senior players, you know. So my personal answer to the first two, because I was the only one that could answer those, was yes and yes. So I believed I still could really make a difference. I still wanted to do it, but would the players still want me there? And if they didn't want me there, then there was no point in going because I wouldn't be able to get them to work with me or follow me or listen to me. So I checked in with the senior guys and they were yes. So I was able to go to the board and paint a picture for the next 20 months, which was my shelf life, to say that, you know, this is where we're going, this is how we're going to get there. Here's Everest, this is what we'll achieve if you give me the opportunity to do it. So yeah, the shelf life plus I think, you know, integrity is just such an important part of leadership that gave me that chance to finish with a fairy tale.
I think, one of the things I wanted to go back to is that concept of buy-in. You know, you talked about Martin Rampakash kind of not having that buy-in. Is it Mark or Martin? I can't remember.
Yeah, sorry. Mark.
Mark, yeah, not having that buy-in originally. And as a principal, like coming into a new role, you probably don't have any idea, like you didn't, whether you were going to have buy-in from a senior leader or your senior leadership team. And I guess I'm interested in that notion of, you know, how quickly you knew that you didn't have that buy-in, how quickly, again, that you kind of continue to see that you weren't going to get that buy-in. And I guess kind of going back to one of your early points, that recognition in yourself that this was not going to be a great fit? And in hindsight, was there anything more that you could have done in the exploratory phase of going for that role, you know, to understand before you kind of were immersed in it that you weren't going to find alignment?
Well, yeah, the easy answer was that I pushed way too quickly, you know, in that case. So when I look back with the Queensland role, and in a sense when I looked at the Australian role, which came later, therefore there were some learnings out of what had happened previously, I just was pushing too quickly. I was trying to do two full-time roles and sandwich them into one. So that was a big mistake. So in theory, I had learned from that. So when I went to the Australian team in 99, I had insight into how the team operated internally because we had a number of players that were playing in the Australian team and then would come back to Queensland, whether that was in a one-day format or a test format. And they'd come back and tell us a little bit about how the culture operated, how the team operated, individuals in that. And then, of course, it was easy to observe the team, the Australian team, and how they were performing, and they were performing pretty well. You know, they'd won a World Cup in 99 and won in the West Indies. But I just saw up and down performances and individuals up and down, and maybe some selections and maybe something around fitness and certainly something around culture and certainly something around staffing. So when I went into the Australian team, I thought, right, well, I need to find out. I need to find out. I need to either confirm or modify some of the things that I believe need change here. So I spent the first 9 months in that Australian environment. So we played two test series at home against India and Pakistan and a one-day series, which we won everything but for one one-day game. And then we had the opportunity to tour to New Zealand, where again we played three tests and 5 one-days and won all that. So at that point, I said, right, I reckon now I've got a really good handle on what needs change to take us into the future, because that's how I was promoted. I was the coach for the new millennium to take the team into the new millennium and you know, set us on its way to continued victory. So I put all that together and put that in a report to the CEO. I met with the CEO, who I hadn't met for any length of time. I met him every so often. He'd drop into a game and have a quick chat and then leave. So this was my report, and this was our first meeting. I went into the room and I can still kind of get the gist of the first parts of the conversation. And he said to me, welcome. And he said, did you use spell check in your report? And my immediate thought was, wow, I think we'll get on really well here because I like a dry sense of humor. And so I said, no, I didn't use spell check. And he said, I can't remember the word, but there's a word in there that you can use one of two ways because it's either an I or an E. I know it was incumbent. And it might be an E and an A at the end, incumbent. And I said, I didn't. He said, you used it the wrong way. And I said, oh, okay. So I'm thinking, oh, I'm really pressing this point here of dry humour. But then I realised very quickly there was no humour there because then he kind of hit me with the big punch between the eyes. He said, you must be the most unhappy person in the world. And at which point I was quite taken aback and a bit confused and try to understand why, because obviously here I was coaching the Australian team. You know, I'd obviously wanted to have worn the background, but not good enough to do that. But here was the next best thing, having coaching this side, and we'd won everything but one game. How could I be unhappy? And so he said, you must be the most unhappy person in the world. And why is that? He said, well, all I can read in this report are all the changes that you want to make to the side. And that was around personnel, it was around technology, it was around some systems, e.g. selection systems, some of the communication and so on. And he just said, I never want to ever receive a report like that again. right? You just give me the facts and the figures and none of that rubbish. So to your point, one, I rushed the things that needed to happen in at Middlesex, which was a mistake. It needed time and I needed to give it time and I didn't necessarily give it the appropriate due time. Here with the Australian team, I'd really given it some time, but I hadn't read the tea leaves. I didn't know the boss. I was, you know, the so-called managing up, you know. So principals will need to manage up. They've got to manage their boards. They've got to manage their parents and friends associations, and then they've got to be able to manage sideways as well. So while I'd got a really good feel for the team and what needed to change, there was nobody else out there that understood that. And then I was pressing this forward, which was, a bit of naivety, I think, in my regard. And then to continue that story a little bit further, in 2008-09, the Indy Premier League started. So I was appointed coach of Calcutta Knight Riders. And, it was just unbelievable. It was just T20 cricket mixed in with Bollywood, with fireworks, lights and dancing girls. It was just an amazing scene. And in our team, we had Sourav Ganguly, who had been captain of India, and we had Ricky Ponting and Chris Gayle and Brendan McCullum, you know, a whole range of superstars. And as the season went along, I began to see how this game was played because it was still only a new format, really. Hadn't really been exposed and certainly hadn't been put into an entertainment vehicle and wrapped up with glitterati from Bollywood. So I kind of was picking this up as we went along, and about two-thirds of the way through the season. And also, I should add to that, our owner was one of the, and is still one of the kings of Bollywood, Shahrukh Khan. And I'd meet him every so often. He'd only meet at 10 o'clock at night, 11 o'clock at night, because he'd kind of work through the day on his film projects, then rest up, and then begin to come alive later in the night. And so that's when you got an opportunity to meet. But he had a real vision, which I was totally supportive of. He wanted to make Knight Riders into this Manchester United of the cricketing world. And I guess the reason why I'm saying this too is because if you are a principal in a school, then that to me is what you're actually trying to do in your school all the time. You're trying to create a picture and a vision for staff, for students, for all the stakeholders to come to this concept of buying into. Because, again, for me, we talked about Everest, and that was a picture that I'd painted for the Australian team around Everest, and Everest was always about changing the game, you know, so that just like school principals, you play in a set of rules that governs the way that you can operate an educational institution. We operated within a set of rules that said this is a way that you can play cricket according to International Cricket Council's law book. So that's okay. But inside that, why we got to play the same game as every other team around the world? And that would be the same to me for every principal. Why has a principal that has the influence to actually be able to run their school differently to the school next door? So that was really important. So Shahrukh Khan, yeah, that's what we wanted to be, and I was right with that. But as I discovered through that particular season, people like Sourav Ganguly, the captain, and Ricky Ponting and a couple other guys, the game had sort of passed them by, you know. Come 4 years earlier, 5 years earlier, they would have fitted in nicely. But now the game had advanced. This was a different format. Their skill sets, technically, physically, even mentally, were not where they needed to be. So I had this conversation with Sourav and told him, mate, I don't think this is the right place for you. I think you should step aside and take another role for Knight Riders, where an ambassadorial role or whatever, so that it's not going to tarnish your brand. And of course, you know, he didn't agree with that. But the owners, you know, when I meet with the owners, we support you there. And of course, when the three of us met, the owners, Sourav and myself, they supported Sourav. So again, he was the question that I'd faced in 98, I suppose, and through my career at different stages. Did I want to hang on to the job? Yes. Did I want to compromise my principles? No. And it was the no that won out. And then, yeah, I was replaced second year as coach. So, you know, I think all of those things in terms of coming to the original question, Luke, about buy-in. Buy-in is, it's an ongoing affair that certainly if you try to rush change, as I did at Middlesex, I just don't think that's going to work. If you take time to understand what changes are required, then what becomes really important is then how you sell that, how you sell that up, how you sell that down, how you sell that sideways. And then, of course, it's so important that your buy-in is bought into by the real senior leader. So in the Cricket case, the captain and the owner or the chairman of the board or the CEO. If they're not buying in, then you're in big trouble as well.
As a leader of a school, you're probably well aware that on average around 80% of the cost of running a school is the salaries and on-costs of its workforce. Yet most schools do not have comprehensive visibility of their workforce data and metrics. That's where PeopleBench excels. Through their painted and workforce benchmarking strategy platform, they use data science, machine learning, and predictive analytics to provide insights and resources to support school leaders become self-sufficient in responding to the future of work in schools. The platform can benchmark your workforce data to other schools, build your workforce strategy, and monitor progress on metrics like teacher resilience and workforce culture, while keeping an eye on how those factors impact student outcomes. A PeopleBench subscription provides your school with access to school workforce research, benchmarking tools, dashboards, reports, their workforce resilience tracker, their workforce culture tracker, their workforce strategy builder, and their community of practice, including online networking and professional learning modules. So do yourself a favor, if you haven't already, head back to episode 78, where we chatted to CEO and founder Fleur Johnston, and then head to peoplebench.com to learn more.
Oh, there's so much in that to sort of continue to unpack. And, you know, John, you just sort of started to describe that concept of Everest. And I know, you know, since you've moved away from cricket, you've developed your business and you sort of describe this notion of, you know, what's your Everest? And I wonder if you can sort of unpack, I guess, the model for individuals and coaches and teams and, you know, how it leads to success. I'd love to hear more about it.
Yeah, sure, Luke. So it is what's your Everest. And as I said, with the Australian team, that was kind of the vision, you know, where do we want to be? And so that was the story. And Everest conjures up the images, I think, of obviously top of the world. But to get there, what do you need? You know, you need teamwork, you need talent, you need hard work, you need discipline, you need training, you need preparation, you need luck. You know, so a whole range of things go into making up this journey to the summit, to Everest. So as I looked at it, once I'd finished with the Australian team and then going into the corporate world, I did need to sort of commoditize the concepts and the methodology. So I designed What's Your Everest, and What's Your Everest has, you know, four stages. So firstly, there's a base camp. We've got to understand base camp. And when I say we, there are the three parts of any team or organisation. So, you know, again, in a school is made up of a whole set of individuals, you know, whether that's teaching staff, whether that's operational staff, whether that's support staff. So it's made up of a whole set of individuals. Then, again, in a school or in a cricket team, there are leaders, both formal and informal. So the formal leaders either, you know, head up a department of mathematics or, you know, are the chief operating officer or the chief financial officer, you know, or the head of the maintenance staff. So, you know, there's a whole set of leaders, which means there's a whole set then of teams and which means there's a whole lot of wheels within the big wheel. So going back to the cricket team, when I came into the team in 99, Cricket Australia, who's the organisation that the Australian cricket team sits within, had a vision of making cricket Australia's favourite summer sport, which is a lovely vision for the overall organisation and something which I think most people could understand and buy into. But I just didn't think that was the appropriate or the right sort of vision for this wheel, the Australian cricket team, to inspire and challenge and stimulate and continually seek improvement. So that's where the Everest idea came from. And then Everest was also linking into history and tradition. So the idea was that, yes, we're about to change the game, and then hopefully by the time that our team disbanded, meaning most of us had sort of retired or been moved on for whatever reason, we would be given a label just as a famous Australian cricket team in the history of the game and the traditions of the game had also been given a label, which they were called the Invincibles, which for those who follow cricket or don't follow cricket, Sir Donald Bradman was captain, 1948, unbeaten on a tour through England. So by the time we finished, hopefully we would also be accorded a label because of the impact that we'd made on the game. So Basecamp then is all about, from an individual's perspective, when you play at your best. So again, all of us today, you know, hopefully at the end of the day or right now, because maybe it's the start of the day for many people, right now it's about saying, well, when did I play at my best? You know, so was it a meeting or was it all day yesterday or was it a project? You know, and when I walked away from that, I said to myself, wow, I don't reckon I could have done any better. So generally it'll be related to a result, but sometimes not, because the important part is you know that you did your best, your absolute personal best. And so that becomes Basecamp. And from Basecamp, that inspires a strategy, or strategy means game plan. So that's our next level up, right? So we move from Basecamp, we go up to our overall game plan. This is our winning model. So based on when I'm at my best, what am I doing? What's in my control? Albeit there'll be other factors that either impact negatively or impact positively, but I can't control those. But what I do control is me and how I deliver me, you know, on a hour-by-hour, daily, weekly, monthly, yearly basis. So what's my winning model in there? And then from that game plan, that then what I term mobilizes your set plays. So your set plays become really evidence base from your philosophy. So if I say my philosophy, you know, one of my parts of philosophy is about vision, well, then I'm going to enact that in everything that I do in my set plays. So that might be in a conversation with somebody. That might be putting it into a budget line by way of that's where I want to be. Okay, so here's something that I need resource to get me there. So that then goes into a budget line and that's going to help me get there. So set plays are the evidence. So if we say again that, you know, we want to, in this school, you know, they have all their school mottos. So whatever those words might be, which are really important, which is a mantra for the school, which to some degree is a vision, then how do I see that being enacted? How do I see that being enacted by my staff, my teachers, my pupils? How do I see that being enacted? Because they're the set players. They're the things. If we do those things, an individual does those things, what it does is give them best chance of performing at their best. No guarantees. But potentially what is guaranteed is if, one, you don't understand the things that enable you to perform at your best, and then, two, you don't do them, then it's more than likely you'll never go near your personal best. So we need to understand those set plays. And then from the set players, the last part is then reaching for the summit, which is the review and the reflection. And it, again, it is about, well, how did the day go? How did the project go? How did the meeting go? And importantly, not to leave it too long. Because, again, the best sort of feedback, the best advice I can give people is that you need to have that review or that reflective process as immediate as you can make it and as accurate as you can make it. Because if you do that, then it really has the capacity to either accelerate what you're doing well or modify what you're not doing well so that you can quickly adjust and, again, get yourself back on track. So they're kind of the stages from base camp, develop your game plan or inspire your game plan, which then mobilises the set plays, your actions and behaviours that you can regularly do and regularly see, which then takes us to the summit. And the summit is just a constant review, reflective process because based in I guess, my philosophy and values is one about never being satisfied. And it's not about being unhappy, but it's just saying, you know, that the biggest room in the house is the room, you know, room for improvement. And so I just believe that there's always things that we can continually improve. And so that's why review and reflection becomes really important. And so that's kind of the individual. We do the same for the leader and we do the same for the team. The ultimate summit for the individual is about being your own best coach. So if you're a staff member or if you're an athlete or if you're just an individual, what do I do to give myself best chance of having the best possible day on my PB? So to do that, I need to understand how I do that. So that's being your own best coach and in a sporting sense, but it's still in any role, I break that down into your technical skills, your physical skills, your mental skills and your tactical skills. So that's kind of the summit for the individual. The summit for the leader is the legacy. You know, so if I left today in my role as a leader, whether it's small team, big team, whatever team, if I left today, what have I left behind? You know, can the people that come behind me actually stand on my shoulders and keep improving things? So what's my legacy? And then from a team point of view, I always want the team to be the dominant player in their marketplace, whatever that, however they define dominant, however they define marketplace. But that's the summit for them. So that's a bit of a brief on what's your Everest concept and the framework.
Look, lots of questions you can ask out of that. But one that I want to, a thread I want to pull on there is around that self-coaching. You know, like, you know, in a sporting context, there's obviously, I think you mentioned like the physical skills, like the mental skills that kind of go with that as well. And I think in schools, we do a lot of work around the technical skills, like how do you teach? How do students learn and, you know, what can you be doing with your, I guess, for want of a better description, your physical skills around what you're doing on a day-to-day basis. But I don't think that we do much in terms of the mental skills that, you know, that come with being in a classroom environment or a school environment, you know, week to week, month to month. And I'm kind of interested in the notion of, you know, like a lot of times people will say that the difference between the good players and the great players in a sporting content is their mental game, that mental aspect. And I'm wondering if you could share any light, you know, on what you either coached players to do or what you saw players to do to increase that mental capacity or their mental skills, you know, in their self-coaching.
Yes, well, I guess it goes to that word coaching and so... You know, in my mind, obviously, I was dealing with elite cricketers and my background wasn't that I wore the baggy green. So to coach, my view was always about getting the players to understand maybe what the issue was or the problem was and then trying to encourage them to solve that, to work that out, work their way through that so that they not only defined the problem but then they found the solution. And while I certainly could mentor that at certain times, meaning that I would have had certain experiences which I could add to or complement that process of moving from problem to solution, I really wanted them to explore that as much as possible. And so in that, if you like, in that mental area, and these days, I guess I try to move away from the word mental and put it more into performance mindset or something along that line. That, as I said, to perform at your best, one of the skills in there is what you're doing with your mind or what your mind's doing to you. And sport really and in cricket, in a sense, is one place where you can see it almost in action. So we can't be mind readers, but we can actually view somebody getting their mind right to either deliver a cricket ball or face a cricket ball or field a cricket ball. Other places that you can see it and view it in action would be goal kicking. You know, whether that's soccer taking a penalty shootout, whether that's AFL, you know, kicking for your goals, or again in rugby league or rugby union, you know, just kicking for goal. You can see almost the performance mindset. And so everybody has one. And that's why I always ask them to try to go back to when they're at their personal best. So what enabled you at that time to make good decisions, which then you used your technical and physical skills to execute to get a really very, very good result or a personal best. So what were you doing? What happened? And that's not easy, because most people are not stopping to think about what it is that they're doing to basically clear their mind. So when I go back to those sporting examples that I just mentioned, what is happening for those athletes is that they're very much aware of their surroundings. And as they become closer to their action, whether it's bowling a ball or facing a ball, fielding or kicking a ball, as they come closer to that point, then their whole world is narrowing to a point where, as a batsman, all they know, all they can see, all they're aware of, all their focus is on a red ball or a pink ball or a white ball. That's all their world is. For a goal kicker, all it will be in the end is that ball that's sitting on a tee or that's sitting on the ground that they're about to kick or they're holding in their hand. So that's their world. And so people at work do that. That's what we do constantly, you know. So if we're in a conversation right now, hopefully you guys are listening to me and your mind is nowhere else but what we're talking about right now. But if I say to you now, and you can say to the viewers, I can literally, through this screen, control your mind and you will have no say in that. You're probably saying, get out. So now let's see whether I'm accurate. If I say to you, don't think of an apple, where does our mind go? I think for most of us, it's gone to the apple, right? It's gone to the apple. And so in terms of being very good at making good decisions, there are all those noises that are around us all the time. But the athlete in those examples that I mentioned close all those off, they lock all those out, and so the apple doesn't appear. All that's going to appear is, as I say, that cricket ball. And therefore, with that sort of clear mind, they then, the athlete that is, or again a staff member or whoever it might be, we reach back into our compartments and search. Obviously, as a batsman, you've only got 0.3 of a second to do this, so it's pretty instantaneous. But you go back and search through all your knowledge, all your experience, all the visual cues that you're getting from the bowler in terms of the position of the ball, the hand, their wrist, where they're releasing from, etc. And that enables you then to pick out a solution. So clear mind, there's no apples in there, there's nothing else in there, it's just a clear mind that says that is the solution I need right this moment, and now I'll put that into, or I'll now use my technical and physical skills to execute that decision and hopefully then get that result. So to me, that's the process. I'm sure, you know, there's a lot of neuroscience around, there's a lot of psychology around, there's a whole range of things they might put different labels on all that and may have a different approach and so on. But from my experience as a coach dealing with athletes, that's what we're going through and that's what we're trying to get our athletes to be. I'm currently coaching at a boys' school, private boys' school in Brisbane Boys' College, and coaching their first 11. But we're talking about how we gradually instigate this performance mindset into the 5-year-olds, the 6-year-olds, the 7-year-olds, or grade 5, grade 6, grade 7, etc. Because by the time they reach first 11, you want these things in place. They shouldn't be learning them by the time they're 16 or 17. And so, therefore, for me, this whole thing about being your own best coach and those sets of skills are really, really important in a schooling environment. And this is part of the schooling environment, a sporting team within the schooling environment, is to be able to develop that process so that they are their own best coach. It means that they can problem solve. And then hopefully we've given them enough skills that they can execute that problem solving.
And John, you sort of described there just how important it is that, you know, if you're going to be your own best coach, you have to have significant insight into self and you need others around you to help unlock that. But also part of that is that idea of professional trust, that without trust with the coach, without trust with the leader, that's really, really hard to do. Does that resonate?
For sure. You're so right. To do any of that, basically, just as the child-parent relationship, the child expects of the parent, if you like, to behave in a certain way. The athlete expects the coach to behave in a certain way. To be consistent is probably the key word. And if they're consistent in terms of going back to where we started this conversation, if they're consistent in delivering on their philosophy, their values, their principles and so on, then the child or the student or the athlete knows what to expect. But if the coach or the leader or the parent are person A one day and then person B the next day, then the child, student or athlete begin to question, well, who's going to turn up tomorrow? What if I tell this person today something, but the person who turns up tomorrow has a completely different view to that? So what do I do about that? So therefore, can I trust this relationship? And the answer is no. So therefore, the coach, the teacher, the principal, the leader need to clearly understand their philosophy, principles, values, etc., and live them. Now, that means that you're not going to necessarily be popular all the time. That means you're going to make decisions that people are not going to like. But I go back to what I said earlier as well. This is kind of where leadership now steps in, is that if you choose to compromise at any stage to actually either get an outcome that you want, protect your job, as I was saying before, or to feel like you're going to be everybody's best friend, and you continue to do that, then nobody knows who you are, and therefore nobody can actually really establish a strong relationship, because, again, really good leadership, really good coaching depends very much on strong relationships. Now, those relationships also may not necessarily be close, but at least they're strong, because the ones that are not close are probably different values, different backgrounds and so on. So I could say that my relationship with a Shane Warne as opposed to my relationship with Adam Gilchrist or Ricky Ponting were completely different, simply because there were values, there were backgrounds, there were beliefs and so on inhabiting all of us that either drew us together or pushed us apart. But my job was still to be me, to keep as consistent in the delivery of my values and principles, philosophies as I possibly could. And so that develops a relationship, close or far, and therefore that develops trust between coach, student, coach, athlete, leader, principal and staff. you might choose to wear a mask every so often. A mask is, you know, you can have a style that you prefer to operate in. But sometimes, some days, some meetings, some occasions, you feel that it's necessary to change your preferred style into some other style for that time. But sitting in underneath all that is your philosophy, values, principles, et cetera, which don't change.
Look, John, I'm mindful of your time. It feels to me like it's been the quickest one-hour interview we've ever done. But before we wrap up, we have my favourite segment, which is 6 in 60 seconds, one word or idea. You know, we've only got 5 today, but that's okay. Matt loves this segment because it's a little bit different. No one ever follows the rules. So with that, let's get started. What's one thing that you're most proud of during your career?
I think the ability to impact on players and watch their development.
The most underrated role in a team or an organisation?
In cricket, I think it's the 12th man. The 12th man wants to be on the field but can't get on the field, yet they're so integral in keeping the team together and looking after the team and being the conduit between coaching and support staff and those on the field.
Great answer. The most interesting human you've ever met?
Yes. I did meet Archbishop Tutu in South Africa at one stage, so he was a pretty interesting character.
I'm sure there's a bit to unpack there. One book worth reading?
I've got a book, If Better As Possible, but no.
Good plug, I like it.
Nice one.
You should definitely read that to the audience.
That's right, yeah, get that one. It's on my website. Viktor Frankl, you know, The Meaning of Life. I think that's a really powerful, insightful book.
And one person we should interview on the podcast.
Well, given you're an Ed Leaders podcast, I'll put in a plug for my brother-in-law, Mr. Peter Fulliger. He's principal of St. Joseph's College, Nudgee, and been there, I don't know, maybe 7 or 8 years and just done an amazing job at that college. And, you know, his philosophy, his values, the way he goes about it, worth a listen to, I think.
Excellent. Maybe we'll get you to connect us to him. Well, that brings an end to our show for today. I hope you've enjoyed our little chat with John. Matt, closing comments, hit us. I know you've got them.
I have pages and pages of notes all over my desk at the moment from that conversation, John. But, you know, for me, the couple of sort of standouts is that notion of buy-in and don't rush it, you know, that idea of listening and learning your way into an organization, I think it's a great life lesson. That notion of not compromising on your principles, be consistent, I think, you know, really, really hard in the day-to-day, but I think it's the benchmark we all should be attempting to follow. And I really thought that was an interesting conversation around the refresh, you know, that Wayne Bennett concept, you know, I'm leaving, all the players are leaving, and how do you refresh the people around you? And I think from the bottom up, teachers are very good at saying, "I'll replace the leader. We're done. We're done with that." But what if leaders were to think differently about that, particularly the leaders that are around them, and refreshing in a different way? So, look, but I could give you a list of other pieces of gold that I've got out of today, but there's just a few. Luke, what have you got?
Well, for me, I had underlined understanding your own philosophies and how important that is. You know, right from the outset, it felt to me that you had a really good sense of what your philosophies as a coach or a leader were going to be. And sometimes I wonder whether leaders really understand that or spend the time thinking about that as for themselves before they get into leadership roles, and particularly principalships. So I think there's something really interesting in that. I had also noted like the buy-in factor. And I think at one point you mentioned selling the buy-in. And I think, you know, how important that is around getting a group of people to go in a similar direction and climb their Everest together. I kind of also like that notion that I felt like you were kind of, what you were describing was you understood your own shelf life or your recognition of yourself, and you understood that when you were right for a role and when you weren't, and that you weren't going to compromise on what your philosophies were or your values. And I think that notion of being able to reinvent yourself, you know, throughout your career and particularly as a coach, and learn from, you know, scenarios that you've been in before to try different things in the future is super important and relatable for a leader, because sometimes what works or what you think is going to work, you know, may not work in the next context. And the one last point that I thought was quite fascinating was the three questions that you kind of posed or had posed to you when you were kind of at the end of the 2005 series, and particularly that third question: what are your senior players or your senior leaders around you feel like, or what's their sense of your leadership? And I'm just not like, I don't know if that happens enough in education or particularly in corporate world. You know, do we really go and get honest feedback, or does a council go and get honest feedback about a leader around, you know, do the senior players around the squad or the senior leaders around a school, are they still bought in? And is this person past their shelf life? So I think there's a few interesting things for people to consider there. John, really want to thank you for your time today. You know, for the audience out there, if they want to connect with you, where's obviously the best place to do that? You talked about your website and maybe just a little bit about what's next for you.
Yeah, so look, best place is the website, buchanancoaching.com, or they can find me at LinkedIn either through my name, John Buchanan, or I've got a little piece there on Buchanan Success Coaching. So they're probably the easiest places. I do have a few of the other handles, but I must say I'm not an avid user of all the other pieces of social media, although probably these days I should, because, as you say, what's ahead? And I really want to continue on this coaching and leadership and being able to take that into more organisations or to more aspiring leaders, whether that be in education or whether that be in heavy industry or technology, wherever it might be. So, you know, I think there are, yeah, so many things that people can gain reasonably quickly and put it into play. So I'm keen to do that. But social media these days would seem to be the key, particularly post-COVID. I think, you know, it's a very, very crowded space, albeit it's a big pool as well, but there's a lot of people out there doing that. But one of the other areas that I'm really interested in, I mentioned Brisbane Boys College, but I really see there's a great opportunity for other schools who have cricket programs and that want to actually develop their cricket program, albeit that they may not be able to access, you know, either people like me, that I will be developing an online cricket program that I think people can, you know, join up to, and I do see that as a real value add to any cricket coaching program. So that's a little future project that hopefully might begin to surface come the new season.
Well, I look forward to following that journey. I'm always interested in what people are doing and creating new kind of programs online and whatnot. And I think, you know, obviously, you know, we've seen a little snippet of the wisdom that you've gained over the last kind of 25 years involved in being a coach and leadership. And I'm sure that many school leaders and principals would do well to reach out and scratch a little deeper on the wisdom that you have as a leader of people. Look, for the audience out there, please remember, if you haven't already, subscribe to the show, share the love, and tell a few of your colleagues that you listen to a great podcast and that you've listened to John Buchanan on this episode, and what a great episode it was. As I mentioned at the top of the show, if you haven't signed up to the Ed Leaders newsletter, please do so. You're missing out. We publish a new issue every 2 weeks, and it's jam-packed with nuggets, as Matt said off the top. Check out edleaders.com.au for more details. Thank you again to today's sponsors. We'd be very grateful if you spent a few minutes of your time going and having a look at their website and supporting them as they support us to make this professional learning free for you. You can connect with Ed Leaders and both of us on LinkedIn, where we'll keep you up to date with all that we're up to. Thanks again for listening, and we'll catch you next week.
Go well.